Hello, I'm Howard Mirziak, founder and president of Lacuna Incorporated. Why remember a destructive love affair? Here at Lacuna, we have perfected a safe, effective technique for the focused erasure of troubling memories. In a matter of hours, our patented non-surgical procedure will rid you of painful memories and allow you a new and lasting peace of mind you'd never imagined possible.
Hello, it's My Favourite Film Podcast, me, Gav Smith. We're somewhere in the middle of Series 3 now. It seems like I've been doing this forever, but there you go. This episode, I was going to say it tonight, but I've decided not to do that anymore. This episode, I am joined by a comedian, Matt Zitron. Matt, hello. How's things?
Hello. Things are okay. My house has just recovered from norovirus.
Oh, dear. That's not a good thing. Not a good thing at all.
No, not at all. It's a memory I'd like to wipe, some might say.
Ooh, that could be a little clue as tonight's film. Just tell us a little bit about yourself, Matt, what you do, that type of thing, and then we'll get into the film.
So my name is Matt Zitron. I am a comedian. I have been going for about 18 months now. I did my first Edinburgh this year, which was a bit of a... Aaron Levine invited me up to do Diorama, which was fantastic fun. Funnily enough, Edinburgh ties back to the film a little bit. Not for me personally.
Okay. I mean, thinking how?
Yes, and I sometimes, because I was there when anyway. Right, okay. But yes, if you Google me, because I do have a funny surname, I used to write on Huffington Post a bit, and I've written some stuff about mental health that I'm very, very proud of still, even though it was many years ago. But yeah, comedy is my main thing, and I perform mainly in and around London.
So if anyone's in and around London, I'm sure they can find you somewhere and go and see your stuff.
Yes.
So, the film. I was going to say it's rather an odd film, but is it an odd film? I don't know. I was trying to categorise it, and I came up with it's Total Recall meets Love Actually, but then I thought maybe that's not right. But it's sort of got those sort of sci-fi vibes of Total Recall with a moving drama, love story stuck somewhere in there as well. Can you tell us what tonight's film is and a plot synopsis, if possible?
So tonight's film is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. It is about a man who finds out his tumultuous ex has erased him from her memory. So he decides to do the same. And then his reaction to losing those parts of his mind.
Good. That sounds like a good little synopsis of it. I think it works. I mean, it's 2004, this film, and I didn't realise it was quite so long ago that it was out, because I seemed to, in my mind, it was way, way ago, like in the early 90s, but it wasn't. It was 2004, which is still quite a long time ago. I remember seeing it at the cinema.
Yeah, but in my mind, it's like 10 years ago. I think that's the problem. It feels like it's not that long. And no, it's almost 20 years.
I know.
Now.
It's amazing. I remember seeing it at the cinema and walking out and being a bit blown away and a bit confused. And I think this is one of those films that on a second viewing means so much more and makes so much more sense. But I think there's lots of films like that people walk out the first time and maybe you're disappointed or whatever afterwards, but then they get it afterwards, after a second viewing. That was certainly my take on this one.
I mean, it's not like, have you ever seen the movie Primer?
No, sorry.
It's this weird indie. It came out around a couple of years later, maybe. It's not a romantic comedy, but it's a sort of modernish sci-fi where the technology, you know, doesn't look too far down the road. That's to do with time travel. That unless you're really, really paying attention, I mean, like, you lose it. And afterwards, you're like, what the what's going on there? I mean, this one, it's very hard to sort of objectively now go, it's not that confusing, because I've seen it so many times. But I think what it manages to do quite wonderfully is it's a relatively simple allegory and a simple love story. You know, relationship story. And it does sort of what I think the best sci-fi does, that just tweaks it, you know, doesn't Star Trek it and go, the inertial dampeners on the fizzle buzz. Everything is sort of it's very like logical. Yeah. And What was funny was on the rewatch, realizing it was 19 years ago, I was thinking, oh God, is this going to be super dated? And actually, the technology in it, though it's old, you know, it kind of doesn't date it as much as you'd think.
It's sort of set. It's that thing of we've set it 2 minutes in the future. So it's not really the future, but the technology is something that doesn't really exist. So it's kind of just in the future to a point where this thing is the mainstream that everyone knows about, mind wipe technology and whatever else. But it doesn't.
Oh, I bet you if you Googled, if Google Analytics had every time it was on telly, how many people search if the technology is real? We're laughing, but the way they do it, the way they map the brain and the memories, I'm assuming some of it must be from like hypnotherapy or something. They must have done some connection.
Yeah, it certainly looks well researched, doesn't it? It looks like it's something that could be real, that this is something that could possibly happen at some point in the future. But I don't know how good it is or how possible it is. It sounds like a great idea.
Well, it is. Well, the company's called Lacuna, which means, and I did look this up, I'm not going to just pretend that I'm this clever. I have, I've done research. Lacuna sort of means like a blank spot, like a hole. And he does admit that Tom Wilkinson in the film says, technically it is brain damage, but it's no worse than a heavy night of drinking, which is such a wonderful like throwaway line, because you go, oh yeah, I get that. And then you're like, oh wait, like, what am I doing when I go out drinking?
Yeah. Imagine that.
The scary thing is what we've lost. That's the thing you also come out of, regardless of your reaction to the story, if you like the film, you're going to think at one point, fuck, what have I lost in there somewhere?
All those different memories that you'll never recall, you never get them back, but someone shows you a picture and go, actually, that was me, I was there. So, yeah. So when did you first see this film?
Well, that's why I was wittering on about Edinburgh at the beginning. So I went to university at Queen Margaret in Edinburgh, where I studied film and media. And as you can tell, it did really good things for my career. I'm now a stay-at-home dad and a dog walker when I'm not doing comedy. But fantastic course, taught by amazing people, and I had a fantastic time. But, you know, when you're studying film, you're looking at all these amazing things, these moments in film history where you're like, this film is going to stand the test of time and be regarded as one of the best. And it isn't necessarily like Oscar-worthy films, because probably if you looked at the list of the last sort of 10 years of best pictures, not many of them would go, oh, yeah, like I remember that film. But at the time, they were a big deal. So it was sort of, it was a wonderful thing to happen seeing this film while I was at uni. I was in my first year. And I saw it in The View in Ocean Terminal, Edinburgh, with my then girlfriend, who I'd been with for about 6 months, and then I went on to be with for another 18, and then we broke up. Which again, this film, the perspective on the film has changed because of relationships. Yeah. But I watched it and I remember coming out of it going, I think I've just seen one of my favorite films of all time. And we're here 19 years later, and well, I'm coming on a podcast to talk about it, which is kind
bizarre,
of
awesome. Isn't it?
It's funny because when going back and watching this, you know, there is so many little things about it that have like personal meaning and have sort of cyclical comeback because of it. And I mean, I'm sure there's lots of films that I could do that to with my whole life, because films, you know, osmosize through the pores of my life. But it's funny talking about this one as I'm going through it, reading little facts and funny things. So as we go through it, people, I apologize for myself sounding like a complete narcissist by going, this happened to me when I did this, and saying about something I did. It's more how it sort of makes me love it more.
Yeah.
That I can see these very personal connections to it, so it just sort of makes me fall in love with it every time I review it, which is kind of what happens in the film.
Absolutely, yeah. So you saw the cinema first time, you said
yes
with girlfriend at the time. Was there something that attracted you to the film to go and see it? Was it, is it like the genre you normally would have watched it? Like it's a kind of, it's a drama type love story with maybe a sci-fi spin. Is that what dragged you in, or was it something else?
Well, I'm a big genre nerd. You know, I worked at Gosh Comics, which is still in London in Berwick Street. I worked there for many years, and I like all those sci-fi and comics. My whole life, like the first proper film I remember seeing as a grown with just my dad is Back to the Future 2, which funnily enough has informed a lot of my, you know, so I liked sci-fi, but actually what appealed to me with this one was partly I was like snooty, I've got to see every indie release because I was at film school. A couple of years before there'd been like Royal Tenenbaum, so that was kind of the genre, the way it sort of sat of with things, that sort of, it felt like independent film made mass-produced, you know, that was for everyone and not just for them. The thing that actually got me to see it was the Tom Wilkinson Lacuna ad that started the trailer.
Yeah.
I watched it again today, actually. It makes it look like this cheesy sort of company, and it made me like so... And then it went into the film, and it's got that Mr. Blue Sky, which... I mean, I'll probably be proved wrong by the internet, but since then, Mr. Blue Sky has been used in everything, but I can't remember it being like that before Eternal Sunshine.
Do you know what? I'm just trying to think. No, I don't think it was. It was obviously a massive song. Because they use it in the trailer. Yeah, it was used in the trailer, and it's used throughout the film at some points, isn't it? So.
Yes, and that's the other thing. Rewatching the film, I had in my mind it was this sort of, and I have seen it like 20 or so times, but I had in my mind, because I haven't watched it for about 5 years, that it was this ponderous indie, like, oh, look at love. But it's got quite a pace to it.
It goes through it, a clip, doesn't it? I mean, it's not a long film, or it didn't seem long when I rewatched it myself. I actually.
It's like 100 minutes odd.
It's nearly the perfect length for a film, which is about 90 minutes. So it's there.
Yeah, you get either side, you get allowance.
Just a little bit of allowance, yeah. And I think the 100 minutes is okay. That's a fair length. But yeah, it does. It clips along. It's not one of these ponderous, long looks at life and changing things and having strange scenes that just don't mean anything. It does go along and tells you the story. You said earlier that you came out of it thinking that was possibly one of your favourite films. So was it an immediate, I love this, now I need to go and see it again, I need to tell all my friends about it?
I became like evangelical about it when it came out. I was like, everyone who would listen, be like, you know, be on the bus just talking to a random old lady, you must see Jim Carrey is... No, I straight away fell in love with it. And what's funny was, because this is 2004, despite only being 19 years ago, everything was very different. It took forever for stuff to come out onto Blu-ray or DVD then.
And certainly there was no Netflix or anything like that. So.
Yes. And I was a student, didn't have a lot of money. And even though Edinburgh Cinema at the time was like £3.50 a ticket, I didn't always have the time or the money to go and see it again. But I remember actually being back home in London, and the only place showing it was like the Covent Garden Odeon, and they wanted 17 quid for a ticket, and I almost fell off my chair. I wasn't even sitting. But nowadays, if someone says 17 quid a ticket, you'd be like, yeah, that sounds standard, normal.
Yeah.
So I think I got the DVD the second it came. I think I pre-ordered it. And then watched it and then discarded it. And then I still have it. It's one of the few sort of physical Blu-rays I still own.
Right. I must admit, it's weird because I love it. I think it's a great film. It was never a film that I felt I could recommend to people. It was that thing of I came out of the cinema going, I'm not sure about it. I think it was great, but I don't know how much of it I fully understood. So I think it's one of those films that you can't preach about too much because it's for a certain type of person, but that's my own take on it. And then rewatch, I'm like, actually, it's a very different film. Now I've seen it again, because when I then watched it again when it came on DVD, it was like, all right, I now understand it a bit more, and now I feel I could go, I'll go and get it on DVD. It's pretty good, but I think at the time the cinema had never gone to the cinema and see it because great. But you were a different way of
I that. Think it may be the crowd I was in.
I suppose.
Yeah,
yes.
I'd sort of and this is sort of going to come into my act at some point, because obviously, and I'm very much aware, I'm a straight white man coming into comedy at 40 in 2023. Yeah. So sort of, you know, there's, I can't do woe is me comedy obvious reasons. And I think it's fantastic. And like, obviously, not to date the podcast, but there's a very famous comedian at the moment in trouble for not being
very good. That's fine.
To women. Yeah. So sort of one of my angles is, and something that really entertains me is sort of what's become of this geeky comic reading film buff that in 2004 and prior wasn't really something someone wanted to be. You were seen as the chubby, specky bloke. You were all a bit, and people would come to you and go, oh, films. Like, and funny enough, to this day, my father-in-law, I'm like he comes to me, goes, what do you think of this? And then he'll take my advice. And my dad is very similar to that. But back then, I was like, oh, well, in this film, and so I was always that sort of preachy person. Of course, nowadays, having that sort of geeky knowledge and that in-depth, you know, thing is okay. Yeah. And so I think I've traversed, and part of the joke in my act is it's like geeks my age or our age are almost put out, because we were like the losers, but we had our comics, we had our sci-fi. And now it's like, yeah, everyone has that. And I think it's absolutely brilliant that my kids love all this shit. And, you know, it's acceptable. You know, I remember in 2004 getting Lego and people going like, Matt, you're 20, almost 21. And nowadays, like, everyone, you know, you see people coming out and I know I've sort of gone off on this weird tangent, but films like this, I think, started, and I think it is kind of like a Fox Searchlight. It's Focus, but they were kind of like, they started to do these independent films that are more thinky, but not too pretentious as some art house. You know, it's not like a Dogma film that's just shocking and a bit OTT. It still has a good narrative structure. It still has exposition and everything you need from a good story. But it's not done in that typical Hollywood way. And I think stuff like this and Will Tenenbaum before it, and then Wes Anderson obviously moved it all forward. Made films like this into your Oppenheimer sort of blockbustery independent film, even though it isn't really. But do you know what I mean? That this acceptance of it by everyone, and it wasn't just cinema knobs that like this thing.
Yeah, it was kind of an indie film that was available to the masses, which I guess is the thing of it, wasn't it? Yeah. And yeah, that's what Fox Searchlight sort of set out to do, wasn't it? Was to bring independent film to the mainstream and go, actually, it's not independent film. There's not some special geeky thing about independent film. Everyone can watch it. They're just films.
I think it's every medium has this idea that they're either one thing or the other. It's like this in comedy, you know, stand-ups might not like improv, or actually that's a bit weird, but like, you know, pure stand-ups might not like people who are pure improv, or, you know, stand-ups might not like these people doing like TikTok shorts that are still comedy, but it's just done a different way. And we're all the same team, essentially. And, it's looking like we're just coming out of this.
Yeah, it's Sims in the 80s when alternative comedy appeared for the first time, you know, taking us away from this idea of a stand-up comic stood and just told jokes, and instead there was stand-up comics telling stories that were just funny stories. But it was the same stuff. They're still just people trying to be funny on stage. So why should there be a difference? But
I think as much as people sort of sometimes turn their nose up at things like Live at the Apollo, Live at the Apollo is almost like making art as comedians, giving us work, because people see it and they accept it and then they spend money on it. And that's sort of what Fox Searchlight did, and Focus, and there's so many others that I can't remember. They made these films. So now, you know, everyone's talking about seeing Asteroid City, because I know I'm harping on about Wes Anderson, but it was around the time that he sort of started to get big that this came out. Michael Gondry hasn't really done, you know, he did Be Kind Rewind after this. but he hasn't really done anything. He didn't have a continuity.
No, I mean, if you look at his IMDb profile, he's pretty much music videos. That's pretty much what he's done. He's done lots and lots of music videos, did lots before this and an awful lot after it as well. And there's occasional bits of film somewhere in there, but he's mainly a music video director, which is...
I think Be Kind Rewind, he had a lot of trouble with it because of the nature of the remaking of films. And I wonder if that soured him to the filmmaking process. Well done.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly, if you look at a lot of video makers, so music video makers, when you see their films, there's kind of that music video thing comes through, which I don't think it does here with Gondry. I don't think that... I would have gone, oh yeah, he directs music videos, having watched Eternal Sunshine. Whereas with a lot of other, I agree.
Oh,
yeah, they directed music videos. That's why that's cutting that.
It's like we rewatched the first Top Gun recently, and you can so tell that Tony Scott used to do car ads because it's just obvious. It'd be like if Hype Williams, who used to make all those hip hop videos, made a film. It's like the end of a spoon. Yeah, you're right. That Gondry. I mean, because isn't he the Daft Punk video with the dog's head?
I think it was Around the World. So it's the one where they're just dancing in circles. Oh,
the stairs. He might possibly do both.
He might have done. Yeah.
But funnily enough, the Around the World video, which has just been referenced in Hey Dougie on CBB. So I noticed.
Wow.
Can I just say, I'm going to say this publicly, he's a 40-year-old man. My children are now 12 and 10. My son is almost 13. I still put on Hey Dougie because it's 7 minutes of just, it's not infantile. It's made so well. The people who made it are geniuses. And they did a music video one called, it's the latest episode. And the cat recreates like Take On Me and all this very quickly. And one of them is Around the World. So Michel Gondry, you need to sue BBC. But yeah, you can't tell watching it. I think if he did do the Daft Punk video with the dog, which I think he might. I'll check
it. Was that one? Maybe he did do that one as well. Yeah,
but it looks a bit like that. But saying that, it doesn't have that feel. You're right, because I think sometimes, you know, filmmakers sort of have a thing, you know, a lens flare or an aesthetic, and it doesn't move like that because music videos or your regular music video are obviously very static, and this film is almost constantly in motion.
Yeah.
I noticed watching it back.
Yeah, there's lots going on, isn't it? It isn't, as I say, it's not music video. It's something very different. I think all his films do have, the ones that I've seen of his, I mean, like Be Kind Rewind, there's something slightly different about them. And I wouldn't have put Be Kind Rewind and this by the same director. Often you can see a director's flair and you can say that's how they do films, but his is very different. And like I say, if you look through the music video selection he's done, because he's done all sorts, you kind of think, actually, none of them are that similar to each other. You know, I mean, he did Mad World, so Gary Jules and Mike Landry's version of Mad World, which is nothing like Around the World. He's done loads of work with the Vines and the White Stripes, and again, none of them gel as being bands that would be the same type.
Did he do the Lego... The Lego White Stripes Fell in Love with a Girl. That might have been one of his early.
I'm looking at his list now, and God, he did. Lego Fell in Love with a Girl. That was him.
So I mean, I think that shows. I mean, that's almost makes me sad because it shows what breadth to his skill there is, and we've not got another feature. I mean, the other thing is as well. Reading up on this, it seems like Kaufman had such a hand in a lot of it.
Yeah. I think he did. I was going to come to Kaufman next because obviously he's an interesting character who's written some really interesting stories. I mean, before this, obviously, Adaption and Being John Malkovich were probably the ones he was known for best. But what do you think of Kaufman's work?
This sort of follows the... I think Kaufman, almost left to his own devices, goes a bit too weird.
Okay.
Like you know, because Adaptation and Being John Malkovich are loopy. They're very funny. He's obviously got this wonderful sense of humor.
Yeah.
But they're very, and now someone is going to correct me how you say this, but Synecdoche, New York, or is it Synecdoche? The one with Philip Seymour Hoffman. That is definitely I mean, again, gorgeous film, very moving. But again, it's fucking weird. It doesn't tell, because Eternal Sunshine tells the story out of whack. Spoiler alert. It tells it sort of back to front, but does it wonderfully. But it really has a... the way the story is told, it's quite normal. You can get there, and even though it's a bit round the houses, but a lot of the other stuff he does just sort of has these dangling threads or sudden pauses, and then they're kind of... I don't want to say pretentious, because I don't think he's trying... I don't think it's a put-on. I think it's how he's putting on his work. Kick-started... the animation he did with Dan Harmon, Anomalisa, a few years ago. And it's a play he wrote, I think, before Eternal Sunshine. And then they animated with David Fewlis doing one of the voices. I think it's Jennifer Jason Leigh doing the other one. Anyway, but I first saw it in a cinema with Kaufman standing in front of me. And I got really, I had like a pop, because obviously I'm a bit fangirl about him. And they... just before they sort of put the film on, they asked everyone who had donated to the Kickstarter to put their hand up. And I put my hand up. And where he was standing, he looked dead in the eyes. And he's tiny, but he's terrifying. But again, Anomalisa, fantastic film, great story, upsets you. Yeah. But it's weird. It sort of goes off and crazy. And you sort of are left like a what the fuck moment.
Yeah.
And this one, it does have a kind of what the fuck element.
Yeah.
If you really think about it, and especially like you said, it's that second watch, you get it, and it's quite a gift, because the second watch you get more, but it's not like the first watch is shit. It's like watching a new film, but with extra,
you know what's going on, you know what's going to happen, you know why the bits that are out of sync work together eventually. There's lots of films that on a second watch always make more sense. I can probably list loads, but I won't.
Memento again, because it's another memory film.
Same thing, because you're watching it backwards. To then watch it forwards, it works so much better. But there's lots...
knowing what's coming makes you laugh as well. You sort of...
you know why it's going in the way it's going. You said, Kaufman, you're a bit of a fanboy. So were you a real fan of his work before this film? Would that have been...
No, I mean, I knew... I had seen... adaptation and being John Malkovich, and I knew of him, I knew he was good, but when I fell in love with this film, I just suddenly went, this guy's a genius. And I had this line, because obviously when you're a comedian, most of you are writers as well, so I've always seen myself as a writer. I only came to comedy fairly recently, but I sort of was like, I know I'm never going to be like Charlie Kaufman good, but I'd rather be in a world where I have Charlie Kaufman. Yeah. And that's kind of how I view it. Yeah, and so, it was the way this was put together. Like, I think there's that thing when you're someone who don't necessarily have to be a writer to enjoy this, but when you look at a film, you sometimes look at it from a pure writing point of view. Like, oh, this structure, this, that, it's like pleasing to you, and you're almost more aware of it because you're in that mindset. And watching this again, there's so many little lines, little putaways, little placements. And obviously it's Gondry as well, because, I mean, frankly, I don't think either of them have done something better than this thing. This is, I would say, is their peak.
Possibly right, yeah. Definitely for
Gondry. I mean, obviously, it's just my opinion. Yeah, it's just my opinion, man. Yeah, no. I'm not going to do the Big Lebowski. I'll make one reference. It's just wonderful. I said at the beginning, this sort of narcissistic, how my life has played into it. So I'd forgotten, because I've watched it so many times, you forget little bits, that it starts on Valentine's Day. Well, the film starts on Valentine's Day. Now, my wife and I had known each other for a number of years, but we didn't actually get together until Valentine's Day 2007. And it's just funny that they sort of get together for what turned out to be the second time on Valentine's Day. And there's other moments that when we talk, I will refer to a couple of things.
That's good.
That turn. And again, like I said, this being, you know, being on a podcast because of my comedy and having just done my first Edinburgh, but I saw this when I was at Edinburgh, which was a big part of my life. Again, it's all tying, it all ties back, but I suppose it might just be, you know, your brain making connections. Yeah. Oh, doing the film.
Maybe you'd actually have that part of your life wiped already and you didn't see it in Edinburgh the first time, but some other time, who knows? Anyway, I'm going to do a quick ad break now.
I wish someone would wipe them.
Go on. Yeah. Someone wipe what? Go on.
We've witted on. Yeah, it's fine. Well, the movie Mona Lisa Smile, I want that wiped from my brain.
So you can watch it again because it was so good, or just because you never want to see it?
Yeah, that's it. Julia Stiles. Oh, I'm Julia Stiles. I'm sorry. Carry on.
That's fine. Go do a quick ad break in the middle because I think it's the best place to do an ad break. If you want to get in touch with me here at the podcast, it's myfavoritefilmpodcast@gmail.com. We're on X, which used to be Twitter, but it's now X for whatever reason. It's at myfavfilm. Instagram, it's at myfavoritefilmpodcast. And Facebook, just search at myfavoritefilm. I'm sure you can find our community page and our other page, because we've got two, because someone said that was a good idea. I think it was Gary Coleman, but there you go. All of that stuff is on our website, which is www.myfavoritefilm.com. And I have to keep mentioning them. Our wonderful theme tune was written and performed by the Craig Will Collaboration, whose album, A Long Way Home, is available to buy, stream, whatever, wherever you can get it. Matt, have you got anything you wish to sell at this point?
Well, I'll plug my own Instagram first.
Go for it.
So my Instagram, which is pretty much the only thing I post on, is at justmattzitron. That is at JustMattZitron. I'd also like to plug, I know, my own name. And I also do this thing where I say the N and my surname, I go N for naughty. I don't know why I do it. I've been doing it for years. I'm going to plug some of my nights that I regularly do in London, if that's all right. Compulsive Comedy, which is in Maida Vale. They're on all the socials. Lollipops, which is in Southwark in London, which is, again, on all the socials. They're on a Tuesday, and Compulsive are on a Monday. I'm quite often at those. There's Sunday and Weekend Shtick at the Rose and Crown in Kentish Town, which is also brilliant, that I've done a few times. And obviously downstairs at the King's Head in Crouch End, which is everyone's favourite spot. And I'm going to read off a list of comics I currently work with. Because one of the things I love about comedy, now I've been doing it for a little bit, is, you know, I'm 40 and I'm a stay-at-home dad and all that. So part of what gets it for me is the community aspect. Yeah. And I'm not in competition with any of my peers. I'm just happy to be working with these wonderful people. So I thought I'd list off some people that if you look them up or see them on a bill, you're going to get a good night. But I'll be as quick as I can.
Go for it.
So it won't be. Right. Firstly, Samira Banks, who just won So You Think You're Funny. Very funny. Tim Burland, very good. Nobby Kobayashi, Adam Bromley, Lorraine Hoodless, Thomas Matthews, Rebecca Sangster Kelly, Julius Howe, Tasha Klusky, Scott Oswald, Abby Clark, Ollie Fox, Kimberly Rose, Jodie Wheeler, Baz Rahman, Alex Prescott, Anna Little, and finally, Max Norman, whose show A Pirate Life for me was in Edinburgh and is fantastic.
There you go. That's a good sounding list. So they're all playing around in London at the same type of place as you, are they? So.
Yes, they're all over. Everyone's on socials. Nobby will be the hardest one to find. She's a small Japanese lady. I don't mean she's hard to find because she's a small Japanese lady. I mean her name. She pokes herself as Nobby or Nobby Kobayashi, but she's, again, these nights that I mentioned, I pop on that. But, you know, if you are wanting to be a comic and you're thinking of looking, look on Comedy Collective on Facebook. That's a really good site. And all these people will be on there and they will post if they're on nights. But it's a good way to make friends. That's the best thing about stand-up comedy is the connections and the friends you make.
And if you're around the London area, have a look out for all of those people who I'm sure will be somewhere. Excellent. Right. That was a long ad break. But let's get back to the film then. It's a complex film, but actually it really only revolves around the two people. Do you have a favourite character in the film? Character rather than actor?
It's funny because watching back, I mean, I have an answer, but what's funny is watching back the film, pretty much every male character in it is either a drip or a shithead. I really like, unsurprisingly, David Cross is just fantastic. And it's just some of his delivery. He's only in it for all of 5 minutes across the film. But there's a bit where Jim Carrey is standing with Jane Addams, who was in Frasier and many things, but Frasier's what she first. And they're talking about the fact he's just found out that Clementine has wiped him. Yeah. And as they're doing it, you just hear this banging. And then she turns and it's David Cross and she says, "Can you not?" And he's like, "I'm making a birdhouse, Murray." And he's smoking a spliff. And it's just the way he's... And then there's a bit later on where it, the memory where it's actually how him and Clementine first meet, which is funnily enough on the beach, they meet for the second time.
Yeah.
When they're getting out of the car, David Cross won't let Jane Addams carry the fiberglass wings from his plane.
Yeah.
And she tries to pick up the cooler and he's just so dickish about it. And it makes me laugh. Yeah, it's hard to pick a favorite.
Yeah.
But he comes up as just a laugh. Obviously, Kate Winslet is just magnificent in it.
Yeah. I mean, Kate Winslet got the Oscar nomination, didn't she, for Best Actress?
Yeah, she did.
As it was at the time.
I've not looked at the list of who was on that year.
No.
But I remember at the time being vexed because they both play against type.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the ways that it's quite funny that up until that point, Carrie, it's sort of done some serious roles. But the way he plays it is so pared back for him. I wonder, I was watching it wondering if he was more like that if it's more like him as a person. The way he's sort of shrunken and quiet and eating his words. And she, up until that point, I know she'd done quite a lot, but she's playing almost the Jim Carrey role, this very brash, loud, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And funny. Sorry, go on.
I was just looking to see who actually was also up for Best Actress that year. It was Kate Winslet, obviously. Catalina Monreiro for Maria Full of Grace, Imelda Staunton for Vera Drake, Annette Bening for Being Julia, and Hilary Swank won it for Million Dollar Baby. So that's probably why you were vexed.
Hilary's wank. I mean, I would say that Kate Winslet deserved it because she sort of plays more than one version of the same character. Because technically, when you see her with blue hair, it's really Clementine, but then every other time is his memory. So, and it's not her because she converses with him about what's going on. And it's, you can see, because having read up on it, they all got on quite well and there was lots of improv and getting on, and you can sort of see the chemistry between them. There is an affection there that I think, as good as actors as they are, you can sort of tell that they like each other.
You've alluded there then that you think the best performance in this probably is Kate Winslet. So a lot of your favourite sort of character pieces is David Cross. Your best performance is really Kate Winslet there. Do you have a favourite scene? Go on then. Which is
I do.
Because there's many.
There is a scene, there's many scenes I love, and it's sort of a scene and a bit because they come back to it. But there's a bit where Clementine, and I'm holding up air quotes because actually it's whenever Clementine in the dream is telling him to do something, it's doing himself. And I worked out today why, but I'll get to that. But they go back to when he was four and Jim Carrey's essentially playing himself as a kid and she's looking fucking stunning in a black dress with go-go boots with her hair. And she's like her mum's friend and she's holding a fag like Doc Cotton. And she does it. And the way they shot a lot of it was false perspective. It's not, and I love all that shit, that it's not actually CGI. Yeah. They've not back projected him. They're in the room together, but they've positioned the camera. And it's a stunning scene. It's actually, the film's quite washed out color wise. And I'd say those obviously deliberately, it's a lot brighter because I'm assuming it's like, early 70s it's meant to be, or late 60s.
They
never really say they don't age him necessarily, but the aesthetic of the scene's great. the interaction, there's a bit where just randomly him as 4-year-old Joel tries to open the freezer to get some ice cream. He's like, ice cream. And I remember at the time laughing and going, oh, that's a good impression of a 4-year-old. And having had 2 4-year-olds, it's a sublime impression of a 4-year-old.
It is. It's brilliant. It's fantastic. Yeah.
So I love all that because hands down my favorite scene.
Right. Cool. Is there a second favorite?
Oof.
The one that maybe tells more of the story and actually gives you the insight to what it's all about, I suppose. Because that one doesn't, does it, really?
Right. So it does a bit. And this is what I was alluding to just as I was talking there. So watching it today, what I realized is the sort of message of the whole film is that despite they've had this massive blow up where they've wiped each other, what they've done is they've ignored the fact that they're probably quite good for each other. They bring out the best. And in the end, the thing that brings him back out of it is her, the idea of her pushing him forward.
Yeah.
And it's sort of how he is this very passive guy who, you know, even at the beginning when he thinks the guy next to him is like dent in his car, he just writes, thank you. No explanation. It's the most pathetic, anger, passive-aggressive piece of shit ever. Because firstly, someone's going to go, well, if someone put a bit of paper with thank you on it. You know, even if they had, you know. But anyway, he's this sort of flop who doesn't do much and he's just asking for attention. And in the end, it's her, the idea of her spurring him on, giving him this strength that brings him back to her and allows him to take these choices. So I think actually that scene's quite funny. And it also links to a massive tragedy that I hadn't really realized until today, that right at the beginning of the film, they're talking and she introduced herself and she says, oh, don't make a joke about my name. And he says, oh, I would never make a joke about your name. I think it's lovely. And she goes, oh, what? Not Huckleberry Hound. Oh, my darling Clementine. And he's like, no, never heard of it. And then later on, you find out that he did know, and it was a massive part of his childhood, that Huckleberry Hound doll was his favourite, and his mum used to sing it to him when he's bathed. But because of this whole technology, it's deleted this massive part of his life that really didn't have much to do with her. And it's this sort of, I think it's for him, actually, the most tragic bit of the story. Yeah. Not that they've had this breakup, the way in which your memories work mean that if you are going to delete something, there's other stuff that's going to go as well.
So every mention of Clementine gets deleted from his memory, even though it's nothing to do with Clementine, the girl that he's trying to get rid of. Yeah. It is very clever, isn't it?
My other favourite scene.
Go on.
My other favourite scene, actually, is less to do with story again. Third. Well, it's kind of...
I was meant to like. It's all
right. Right at the beginning, and I didn't notice this until like watch through 4. I think actually it's the first time I watched it with my wife, who didn't like it the first time she saw it because she'd had an argument with her then boyfriend beforehand, which is probably the worst film to watch. I found out, and we were together a number of years. Yeah, exactly. I found out after we got together she didn't like it, and I was a bit like, oh, can I marry this girl? Can I? So I made her watch it again and sort of sat there watching it, and she went, no, it's good. Right at the beginning of the film, and I'm actually, it's lovely that I was with my wife when I noticed this. You know, he goes to the beach and he goes to the house, which right at the end of the film, you find out he'd had an embarrassing thing that he'd left when she wanted to come upstairs and shag him. You can hear her right at the beginning of the film. You can hear a faint audio of that conversation that they'd had in the past. I was listening to it again today. If you sort of, in that beginning bit, when he's looking in the windows, you can hear that conversation. Well, you can hear her voice, definitely. It's very faint and it's on the wind. And I think it's wonderful because, again, it goes back to what I was saying about her spurring him on. She, which is him being her, says, meet me in Montauk. And it's obviously the feeling about that situation was so strong that it stayed. But it's such a wonderful thing that I discovered, you know, maybe 5 years after seeing it. And it really enriches the whole story because it's just because you see how beautifully it's put together.
I mean, I've seen it a few, I can't think how many times I've seen this film, but never noticed that. So I'm going to have to now rewatch it again and listen for that. And maybe it's so quiet that it's just passed me by. But I've never noticed the conversation being there. So I'm going to have to rewatch now again. Oh, no. What a shame.
Oh, no.
Such a shame. But there you go. Okay, then. Favorite line? Is there a line of dialogue? Because I mean, there's loads of quotable lines, but is the one that's like right. that one is what yes. I use.
Okay, so I have a top three that I'll be quick with because I did.
No, that's fine.
I'll start with like the least favorite, and I'll get to my favorite at the end. So there's a bit right at the end where they've broken into this house, the house we were just talking yeah. about, and it's owned by someone called like David and Ruth.
That sounds right. Yeah.
And she says, "Oh, I'll be Ruth. You be David if you want, or you could be Ruth." And then as she's going upstairs, I'm going to change to something more Ruth. And then as she's going up, she says, "I'm currently ruthless," and I just love that line. I think it's just because she delivers it in such a like silly, like almost like she knows it's a shit yeah. joke, but it's a great. That's a good one. The other one is Kirsten Dunst. No, yeah, it's Kirsten yeah, Dunst. Yeah. I was going to say Kristen no. Bell. She's not, Kristen Anna Bell, from no. Frozen. Kristen Dunst is stoned yep. with Mark yep. Ruffalo, who, if you'd watched that film, who would you predict would be a massive star now? I wouldn't have predicted Mark Ruffalo.
No, he wouldn't be the one that was on my list either.
It's really, I remember at the time thinking, oh, this guy's good. But and then he did, you know, obviously 14 going on 40 was just so massive yes. for him. He's not done much since. No. She's really stoned and Tom Wilkinson's coming over and they're both fucking around and he's trying to get things set up so it doesn't look like they've been drinking and yeah. shagging. And she said, "Those eye drops you gave me didn't do shit." And we've all been there. That line just gets me because she delivers it in such a... I mean, they're all... She's brilliant yeah. in it as well. The sort of ingenue she yeah. plays. But everything about her... Yeah, it's very good, but that line's... And my favourite line...
Go on.
There's a bit you find out early on where Elijah Wood's highly awful character, yeah. who's essentially memory raping Kate Winslet yeah. by using her deleted memories to like win her over. Yeah. She calls him Patrick Baby Boy. You see that very early on. Yeah. But there's a bit like where Tom Wilkinson is there and Jim Carrey has worked out that Elijah Wood works at Lacuna. Yeah. And he says, "Oh, who's that guy?" And Tom Wilkinson goes, "Oh, that's Patrick Baby Boy." And it's delivered in such a hilarious way. And he does it. They don't do it with distortion. He just does it with his voice.
It, yeah.
And it always, every time I meet someone called Patrick in my brain, I'm going, "Patrick Baby Boy."
Fair enough. There are some great cameos in this, aren't there? There's quite a cast in it of people that, you just wouldn't expect. Or you think, "Oh yeah, they were in that. I remember now." So it's like, it had been a while since I'd seen it before I rewatched it for this, and I'd forgot that Mark Ruffalo was in it. I forgot that Kirsten Dunst was in it. And actually, when Elijah Wood popped up, I went, "Oh, it's Elijah Wood." No, there's just some people. And as you say, they're not the people that have become famous afterwards are not probably the ones you would have expected to. But what do you think of that?
Well, yeah, Elijah Wood sort of is a dip.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great ensemble. I mean, I've already said Jane Addams and David Cross, they sort of, their relationship and their acting height and everything. The main cast, I can't remember who plays Tom Wilkinson's wife, and I'll look it up because I want her to do her I want to be polite and get her name right. But the actress who plays Tom Wilkinson's wife, she has a great, again, that's one of my favourite bits where Mark Ruffalo's just honked the horn to let him know that she's turned up. And she just walks up to him and slaps him, goes, "Thanks, Stan, thanks a lot." And she has only a couple of lines, but she just, there's a bit when she sort of reveals to Kirsten Dunst that she's been mind wiped. Yeah. She's like, "Don't be a monster, Harold, tell her what you did." And again, she's probably not talked about in other things because obviously Elijah Wood, he's great and his career... Funnily enough, I mentioned Back to the Future too. That's one of his first films. Yeah. He's one of the kids by the arcade machine.
Yeah,
he's great. The Gruffalo's good in it. But again, it's sort of that role that for a while he was stuck in that kind of he brought back for Bruce Banner.
Yes.
Kristen Dunst is great. And again, it's quite interesting watching it that the principal female characters, they've actually got the strength that none of the male characters have.
Yeah.
Because even though it's a male-heavy cast, the female characters all have this agency and this very matter-of-fact, you know, the Tom Wilkinson's wife knows he's fucking around, catches him, and then doesn't blame the girl, blames him for being a shithead. Kirsten Dunst is in love with him and, like, is trying to, you know, she's shown as a giggly girl. But if you're looking at it and seeing an idiot, you're wrong, because she's obviously trying to better herself intellectually and she's fallen for him because of his mind. And then when she finds out what he's done to her, she gets the most wonderful revenge on everyone. And Clementine, at the beginning, she's portrayed as, like, this proper harpy. Yeah, yeah. But as it goes on, you actually see that, you know, she's not a perfect person, and they've got this problem. But she says, you know, I'm not a concept. And I love that. Yeah. I love that she's very much, you know, she smells his bullshit.
Yes. That's a good way of putting it, actually. Yeah. Yeah. Have you found that?
I think she actually says that.
She does, actually. I think there is a line from it.
Well, I haven't. Sorry, I was confused whether I was looking. I'll look while you ask me the next question.
I was just going to say, because obviously, I know we had a little conversation on email about Jim Carrey and his serious roles. And you're right, this wasn't his first serious role. But I think it's the one that...
I'd just like to make clear, we had an email exchange, dear listeners, where you said this. You said, oh, it's his first serious role. And I said, oh, what about... Truman Show. And I want to make clear, I wasn't being like, oh, what about this? I was more like, I actually looked at it again from your perspective. And we talked about this. So Truman Show would, I maybe argue, his first, like, serious lead role. Yeah. But he's still doing the Jim Carrey shtick. You know, good morning, good evening, good night. But then every so often looking pensively into the camera. And then he did The Majestic, which, if you haven't seen The Majestic, I think it's Frank Darabont, if I'm right.
Yes, I believe it is,
It is, because Laurie Holden's in it.
Yeah.
It's about a guy who, he's in a car crash during the McCarthy era when the screenwriters are being made to name names. He refuses to name a name, and he's always been called up in front of the House of American Activities. He crashes, gets amnesia, is found in this town, and they think he's this, like, guy who never came back from World War II. They think it's him. And his dad, inverted commas, owns the local cinema, The Majestic. And Jim Carrey coming back revitalizes this town. And it's more about what happened to towns that were filleted by World War II. Yeah. And it's not quite as broad as he is in Truman Show, but it is a serious role.
It is,
But again, it is almost like out-the-box Oscar serious role.
Yeah.
I like about this that it's very naturalistic.
Yes. And I think that's what I thought about it being...
It was a bit of a shock.
Yeah, I think that's what I thought about it being his first serious role. Because, I mean, you could, you know, you go back a little bit, he did Man on the Moon, which obviously was... He was playing a comedian, but it was a serious documentary about him being the comedian. Strange link that is Andy Kaufman, and this was written by Charlie Kaufman, but we'll not go into that. And even Cable Guy.
Jews controlling the media like me. Yeah. I'm a Jew, by the way, just quickly. I'm not just being anti-Semite.
And also,
Kanye called.
Careful. So you also got to think about even Cable Guy, because Cable Guy was before this, and in that,
Cable Guy is fantastic.
Yeah, but he's not.
People don't talk about Cable Guy.
No.
He's still Jim Carrey, though. He's still broad. But again, it's against... And I like that... And it's again... And that's Ben Stiller, isn't it? Directing that.
Yes.
And anyone who's surprised that Severance is a masterpiece should watch Cable Guy, because Cable Guy is real. I think people weren't ready for that kind of Jim Carrey for Cable Guy, and that's why I don't think it did particularly well. And again, Truman Show helped them accept it. But this, again, I remember at the time, people going, Jim Carrey? But obviously now, if someone says, oh, Jim Carrey's in a serious movie, you accept it because he's done a few. Yeah. And obviously he's done lots of things. But I think this is the one, I think this is the first film where he's playing totally, totally, totally against what he's usually done. It's not his In Living Colour, moving his face, whatever he was on.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what I meant by it being his kind of first serious role, because it was the one that you kind of go, actually, this is not the Jim Carrey comedy cartoon character that we've seen in pretty much all of his other films to this point. This is something very different, and it's the storyline even. It's not a funny story. It's a serious drama type love story. How obviously you've kind of alluded to that. How do you feel about Jim Carrey as an actor, as a serious actor, rather than his comic persona?
I mean, obviously he's never going to be better than he is in Sonic the Hedgehog Part 2. But so I kind
Wait
of
Part 3.
I just about well, Part 3 will come out and it'll blow us out the water. Exactly. Idris Elba, love you. What's going on with your accent in Sonic the Hedgehog 2? My son made me watch it. Well, where are you from? Anyway, Jim Carrey in this is, I think, great. I don't think he's Oscar worthy, just because I think it's as much down to the way the character is portrayed. I think he's fairly, I actually think he's quite a good foil for Kate Winslet. I think he's quite generous with that. One of the things I read was that Gondry met with him and Carrey was in like a depressive funk.
Right.
And Gondry was like, oh, yes, keeps this, brings this to the film. And Carrey tells the story like, look at this business wanting me to stay depressed so that I'm good in the film. And I kind of don't see it like that. I see it as, oh, what he means is bring an authentic depression. Because this character of Joel, he's obviously a depressive. He's obviously suffers from depression. And, you know, I take citalopram myself. So I see a lot of myself in him, even some of the really pathetic bits about him. Like, oh, why do I always fall in love with every girl I see? Back when I was in my 20s, I was like that. And I think a lot of men, and if you're listening and you're like, oh, never like that, bullshit. But I think there is it's easy to forget he's Jim Carrey watching it. And I think that's the sign of an amazing actor. When you're watching things, you know, like, there's people who are good, but like Tony Hopkins, amazing actor, but he's always, you know, like, oh, it's Tony Hopkins. I can, you know, at no point do you sort of forget, or maybe there might be, you know, maybe in the dummy one, but in this, you lose yourself in Jim Carrey and he's Joel. Yeah. You're not watching Ace Ventura. No. You're not watching Dr. Robotnik. You're not watching The Mask. And this is why I think, because he's obviously been very open about his depression. It's such an authentic portrayal of someone like that and the thoughts in their head and the way in which they see things. I think he truly gave himself up to this, because there's smiles and stuff in it. And again, there's, when I was talking about things that, funny connections to my own life. So there's a bit in the film towards the end where they're in New York and they can see a parade with elephants and stuff. That wasn't planned. They were filming, they saw it and they rocked up. And if you listen to it, when she's talking to him, you can hear someone shouting, "Notice me!" And it's a paparazzo trying to get Jim Carrey to take a photo. And I think one of the bits where she disappears, he might say Kate. On IMDb, it said something like, "I might say Kate," or what have you. The reason it ties to my own life is when I was younger, I was a runner on a couple of episodes of the IT Crowd. This is pre what's gone on with Mr. Linehan now, but this is when it was being made. And there's an episode, you can sort of see me in this, one of these scenes, I sort of ruin a scene, where they make an old lady calendar.
I think I remember that one,
And there's a montage of him approaching old ladies on the street to be in his old lady calendar. And the bit that I'm in, if you go to YouTube and watch, he's getting beaten with a handbag and I sort of, in the back, peer around a corner because I didn't know, I didn't have a microphone, so I didn't know if they were finished or not. When they were filming that, I was standing having a coffee break and this bus pulled up full of old people. And in the episode, you see him go on this bus and hand out tickets, right? It was not planned. I noticed the bus. I ran and got the director, went, well, I don't know if it's the director or like the head of production, what have you. And we just ran and got on the bus. So when they were filming it, you had Chris O'Dowd first giving out these cards that actually said, even though you never see them on screen, it says, "My name is Roy. I want you to take your clothes off and I'll take pictures of you." They were going through filming and I was behind collecting the cards again. And these old people were like, "What does this?" And I'm like, "It's nothing. It's fine." And we just got off the bus and I'm sure they signed all the waivers and stuff that they had to. But when I heard that about Eternal Sunshine this week, that scene that's so wonderful and does move the plot along and it shows their life, again, it felt like, oh, that had happened to me. It's just, and it made me fall in love even more.
So there's so many sort of similarities between this and your life. It's just, it's a little bit spooky. slightly worried.
Yeah, maybe. Well, a lot of people, I know people will be talking about this in pubs, maybe listening to this, the 60 billion people that listen to the podcast, obviously, because that's more than people on Earth listen to it, about 10 times each.
That's right.
When Black Mirror will come up, and like, hands up, it's great, Black Mirror is great, Charlie Brooker is a genius. This isn't Black Mirror, and this is nothing like Black Mirror, because even though it's saying technology can be bad, this is actually a very hopeful film. It's a very positive film, and it sort of says, you know, who hasn't gone through a breakup or even just had an argument with your spouse? I've been married 16 years. I've slept on the sofa. You're going through it, and you're like, oh, they're a bitch. They do this, and they're always like this. And then over time, obviously, the time passes, and you realize that they're not. That was a moment in time. And that there are many happy memories, even when, you know, marriages end. There would have been a period of good that you remembered. And it's sort of what the movie does is, in the sense of a night, condenses down the healing of the breakup and then takes away the pain. But then they're almost, I argue at the end, the Lacuna letters are a gift that they can listen and establish that and talk about that, and almost Clementine can listen to how he thought she is and how, and vice versa.
It's a very clever film, and it's got a very clever ending, the way that they do that, to bring them back together. And there's lots of stuff online, if you read it, that it's a loop film, that it all loops, and it's all, they're stuck in this loop, and you're actually watching the same thing is going to happen again and again and again. But I don't think that's people reading stuff into this that shouldn't be read into it.
The original script had a bit that it was going to end with her as an old lady having done it. I think the original script had that, and I took it out. And I think it's good they take it out, because not knowing is a lot. It's a happier ending. I don't mean sappy happy. It's a more positive outlook on love and memory. And the reason it loops is because he does it to himself. Yes. And the irony is that the thing that saves them, that allows him to go back and meet her again, is him realizing the error of his ways, realizing that he had built her in this way. And she's an imperfect person, but he's not an easy person to live with. And that it's more important having her than not. So he puts it in his head. So yes, I'm sure you could say, it's a loop, it go on and on. But I sort of like to think that they just have a normal relationship, because now Lacuna's gone. And there'll be lawsuits and everything. Yeah. And I think that's probably why they took it out.
Hollywood, in their infinite wisdom, love to remake things. Is this one that you think could be remade? Does it deserve a remake? Should it just be left alone on a shelf and never be touched again, and it's perfect as it is? What do you reckon?
Deserve a remake, I think, can have two connotations. Yeah. Either it's like punishment, or, I mean, look, it's not the Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3. It's not a film that lends itself. I think it's watching it again, the sort of only argument would be that the technology is dated, but actually this sort of past aesthetic that, I know I said Wes Anderson a lot, but Wes Anderson uses, you know, even like Sex Education on Netflix, they use this kind of past present thing. And I think younger people accept that almost, and it works with it. I think there's absolutely no need to. I would be furious with Hollywood, but I think there's better things that can be done with memory. I think, I mentioned Black Mirror. Probably my favourite Black Mirror that upset me deeply because it was so good is, there's a Jodie Whittaker episode where her partner rewinds their memory and essentially realises she's cheating, and thinks that his kid is not his kid and all that. And it's an amazing episode. But much like this, it's such a good analogy for a breakup or problem in a relationship that I was quite deeply affected by it, because of my last relationship, the girl I saw this with, ended poorly as much me as her. But obviously at the time I'm like, oh, she's the devil, but you know, it's over. And I met my wife. Well, I'd already knew my wife, but anyway, that is being made into a movie. I think Robert Downey Jr.'s company bought it. So I think, Richard Curtis did About Time, which is kind of a higgledy piggledy meeting someone. It's not memory, but it's fucking with time and all that. So I think a remake would be useless. I think there's much better things you can do with the similar subject matter. You could tell another love story in a similar way without remaking.
I mean, so a sequel type thing, or just something, a reimagining in the same universe, maybe that type of thing? Or is that, again, is that just pointless because it's all there and everything's on the same page?
Do you know what I'd like? I'd like it to be sort of like Blade Runner, where I don't mean in the future, I mean where there's like there's a Lacuna ad somewhere in another film.
Yeah.
That sort of nod that like it can exist in the same universe as like I Heart Huckabees, which is another film that John Bryan did the music for. Something like that. That would be okay. Something, you know, maybe, oh, you could, like in, you know, in Superman things where they're like, oh, that guy in Gotham in the black cape, he's awful. And then you never see Batman. Yeah. That sort of thing. Oh, I want to get my memory right by Lacuna. That's about as much as I'll allow, Hollywood. I'm coming for you.
It's fine. No, I have a dislike for remakes myself, but I think it's so many films get remade that it's worthwhile kind of saying, is this one that could be in that? My favorite film, and I've said this before, is Highlander, and they're just about remake Highlander. And I think, why? Why would you do that? It's just pointless. But it's one of those things. That's what they do.
Maybe they want someone who can do a Spanish accent. That's
Are you saying that Spaniards don't talk like Sean Connery?
My friend, I have my friend Nathaniel Metcalf, who's another comic actually. He does this great impression of Sean Connery in Highlander 2, and they sort of ask where he's from, and he sort of goes, "All times on Hades," and the accent just goes everywhere at once. Highlander, great film. But I mean, look, the thing about remakes is there is a place for them. John Carpenter's The Thing, one of the greatest films ever made, is a remake. Magnificent Seven is a remake of Seven Samurai and all this. And I think remakes or reimaginings, I think like the idea of taking the building blocks and reorganizing them is a cool idea. If someone like, because this started because, by the way, it's Deirdre O'Connell who plays the wife. In Eternal Sunshine. I just wanted to say
that's fine.
Because I feel like she's probably not mentioned in places, and she should. She's really good in a very short time. But so when they got the Oscar, Charlie Kaufman didn't mention Peter Bismuth, who is Michel Gondry's friend, who essentially came up to the idea, how would you feel if you got a letter that said your mind has been, you've been erased from the mind of your ex? And there's, I don't know if it was deliberate because that's all he did, and then Kaufman and Gondry did it all, and he doesn't want to call out someone who just had a quick idea, whatever. But I think the only way a remake might be okay is if from that concept.
Right.
So if you run with that concept without looking at the film, it'd be interesting to see.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's a very white film, is probably the biggest thing I noticed about it. It's a bit waspy. I mean, you know, but
That's off the time though. There was very white films at that time.
Yes,
in Hollywood. That's just the way, unfortunately, Hollywood worked at the time. They've got better.
Yeah, and the argument could be made that it is about a very small cast of people. Yeah. It's a very small unit. So you could argue that, you know, because obviously there is, the music isn't all white. Yeah, you've got Beck singing, Everybody's Got to Learn Sometimes, but there's like Hindi music used in a couple of parts, which have like clever names that play to the whole story I read. Yeah. But yeah, I think if they do a remake, I would hope that it would be slightly more representational of what, you know, the world say.
Yeah, fair enough. That makes sense. Is there anything we've missed, anything you want to mention that we haven't touched on or anything like that?
I've got notes got here. Notes? I'm just looking.
Recording you.
I've got notes. this is going to sound great with me just reading.
Go for it. If there's something you feel needs to be said.
Oh, that's the thing. There's so many wonderful little moments going back watching it for the 8 millionth time that even the beginning, when the film starts, you hear doors slamming, and it's the Gruffalo and Tom Wilkinson getting in the van. But one of the things that I think straight away made me fall in love with it is that Beck, because it doesn't, the credits don't actually start till like 18 minutes in.
A long time, isn't
it? And it starts with him crying at the car. And he's crying and listening to Beck's I Need Your Loving. Yeah. And when I saw it, you know, I'd seen Beck at Reading in like 2002. Yeah. So I liked Beck. And everyone at the time liked Beck. Everyone. Odelay had been amazing years back. He was singing a song that had been like a Baby D track in the 90s. I need your loving like the sunshine, like the sunshine. So I sort of like, and you know, I think I was a London closeted raver in my youth. So it was funny hearing that song that I actually kind of liked. So that kind of pulled me in. The music, John Bryan's music in this is, cool. It's very John Bryan-y. And if you listen to all his soundtracks, but it really fits. And I kind of think this is the first one I noticed him in. But I think the thing that really gets to me is memory is so subjective. It's the Rashomon thing, you know, same story told different ways. And then they sort of, they allude to that. But I like how just randomly they'll be talking, reliving the memory, and then they'll start having a conversation about what's happening. It's particularly at the end. Kate Winslet is doing this whole thing where she's taking the chicken, and then she goes, it's over now, Joel. And she's the same body, but it's a different person talking through her. Yeah. And it's just so that those little nuances through the film.
Yes.
And that's what she says to him. Said, I really had you pegged, didn't I? When she says, I'm not an idea. Yeah. I just think, I think the reason it works and the reason why it's one of my many favorite films is it's so naturalistic with such a weird idea. But the, you know, it's like the best sci-fi works because all it is dressing. You know, Star Wars is the hero's journey. The 2003 Battlestar Galactica has all this like socialist stuff in it. It's amazing. And with this, it's essentially everyone who's been hurt in a relationship. Yeah. I don't care if you stay together, broken up, what have you. You go through these arcs, or hopefully you should go through the arc where at the end of it, you're like, actually, it wasn't all bad. And then you make the decision whether you carry on or stop. And I like the heart behind it. I think it's so easy for things to be cynical. And I think you could look at it as cynical, but I don't actually think that's what they intended. I get the feeling because they wouldn't end it where they end it. If they wanted it to be cynical.
True. They do leave it on a hopeful note, as you said before, Last bit, and I don't know if it's difficult or not. It depends. I suppose you've got this love for the film, so it should be easy enough. Can you sell the film for me in about 30 seconds?
Right, okay. Oh, this is the pressure.
Yeah, very much. Pressure.
Right. It's a film about being hurt in a relationship and how gut-quick reactions aren't always the best. And how sometimes you have to have culpability for your own part in everything. And that there's still hope at the end of the day.
Oh, that's really good. And that was less than 20 seconds. So well done.
Yes. When you're editing this later and it's just me waffling on like a prat, you'll be like, why couldn't it all just been so succinct? I do just any promoters. I do keep to my 5 minutes. I'm good. I don't waffle too much.
I'll leave that bit in for you, don't worry. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. It has been a pleasure to talk about this film. It's, as I said earlier, it's one that I always found difficult to recommend to people. But I think your little insights in there might just help me to do that, and it might make other people want to see it again. I know I did put a shout out on a few social medias, and a lot of people just said that as a film it was perfection. So it's obviously got a lot of love out there from people who have seen it. So thanks for coming along.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm glad you, when you asked me to come on, I chose this because I could have very easily gone genre. And this is still a bit genre, but I think this film, part of the reason it works is it's not gender specific. I think you don't have to, it's not a blokey film. It's not, it's a romantic film that works for everyone. And I think that's probably at its core why it works.
Yeah, it's, I mean, this very often the sci-fi films that it's like, this is a bloke sci-fi film, and that's who's going to enjoy it, or it's a very geeky sci-fi film. This one is not a geeky sci-fi film. It does work on lots of different levels. And actually, you could almost take away the sci-fi element and it would still be something you could watch. Because you can, the sci-fi element's so...
Yeah, it's really just...
It's not. It's just a hook. It's not really... The film isn't about the sci-fi element. It's about everything else. So, yeah. You said your Instagram account was at just Matt Zitron. Yeah. So I'll put that in the show notes as well.
J-U-S-T.
Yep. Go on, do it again. Do your thing.
My regular Matt Zitron one is my personal one because I have children, so I don't want them out to the world. So at just Matt Zitron, JustMattZitron, and I'll be better about putting what dates I'm performing as well.
I shall make sure there's links to that in the show notes. So thank you for coming on, and bye-bye for now.
Bye.
I'm not a concept, Joel. I'm just a fucked up girl who's looking for my own peace of mind. I'm not perfect.
I can't see anything that I don't like about you.
But you will.
Right now, I can't.
But you will. You know, you will think of things. And I'll get bored with you and feel trapped because that's what happens with me.
Okay.
Okay. Okay.
Change your heart. Look around you.